The subject of our great cloud of witnesses was chosen for this year's theme of our convention. And if you stop and think about the title itself, what the Lord has given us, He's saying that these witnesses are for you and for I. And we hope that as we go through this weekend, we'll look at this from the standpoint that these were especially appointed by the Father for us. We'll look at what these individuals did to qualify them to be placed in the Scriptures as our cloud of witnesses. And from that, we'll be able to understand better as to what we must do. Because, brethren, the affairs of everyday life will become the witnesses to the world of mankind. The affairs of our everyday life will become witnesses to the world of mankind. There will be no experiences that we have whatsoever that will not be of value to the world. Your life is important on a daily basis. And from that standpoint, we hope that the lesson of our great cloud of witnesses will help us to understand and appreciate that and be more faithful on a daily basis. Our first speaker for this convention is our dear brother Bob Gray, one I've walked with for many years and appreciated so much his example that he has given to myself. And he's going to talk to us about Deborah, Barak, and Jael. Brother Bob. Lord bless you.
Thank you, Brother Laddie. Thank you, Brother Laddie, and Brother Duane as well. It's a joy for Sister Rebecca and I to be with you this morning, and I don't know if I'm too loud or too soft, so it's okay. That's good. That's really a blessing to hear. We bring you love from the brethren at New Brunswick. I think many of them would like to have been here. Some are here, which we're very thankful for. And we also bring greetings from our son Jonathan and daughter-in-law Becky. Brethren have been praying for this convention from across the country. We've heard from different ones who were concerned about us in terms of the subject matter they wanted to hear and to participate in from the other side, sometimes on the internet. We're very thankful, again, to be with you. We thought this morning the first thing we would do is to turn to Hebrews chapter 11 before we actually begin our service of our presentation. Take a few moments to read from before us. Chapter 11, now faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Sometime, just take that apart. Faith is the evidence. Faith is the evidence. I would read more, but that's what the whole subject is about. Turn to chapter 12. Wherefore, seeing we are also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despised the shame, or counted as nothing the shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such contradiction of sinners against himself, lest ye be wearied and faint in your minds. Ye have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. Or, as some have read it, striving for the sin offering. Keeping those texts especially in mind, the rest of this weekend should fit slicing itself right in between them all and become for us an Ebenezer from which we can begin to go out and to try to live the life that will bring into harmony that which we have in the past as examples and that which we want to see fruition bear in the kingdom, where if we are faithful, we'll have an opportunity with Jesus to bless the world. Can you see the cloud of witnesses around us, rooting and cheering for us as we run our race? Remember the scripture that said about Abel, though dead, yet he speaketh. Well, that's the way in which all of these ones of the past speak to us. And yet, God is the God of the living, so we know that yet they have life. You know, when we have gotten tired of running, when we are weary, or when we start running in the wrong direction, or perhaps we've even fallen flat on our faces, that crowd at the grandstand is there giving a roar of encouragement. I've been told by runners that some runners will actually look for the extra enthusiasm that a crowd can give them, literally. And I think we sometimes need that extra encouragement from the cloud of witnesses that are around there, as if they were in the grandstands shouting to us, don't give up. Don't look back. You can make it. And yes, with God's help, each of us can make it. But that requires being faithful. Yes, we can be faithful. The record that is left by the cloud of witnesses is the record that we are going to be picking at this weekend and looking at different portions of with our brethren. We're going to be looking at the lives of our fathers and our mothers, so to speak, of faith. Individuals who have given of themselves that we might have the opportunity to run also. Individuals who have had such faith that we sometimes think to ourselves, how could I ever, ever, ever do something like that? We're going to be looking at a couple of ancient worthies this morning. We want to be encouraged by their lives. And to get a good view of them, we will go to Mount Tabor. There we will meet Deborah and Barak. And you can see a picture of Mount Tabor on your handout. It is viewed actually from the hills of Nazareth. And up the valley you would find Megiddo, and down the valley you'd find the Mediterranean. Actually, in both the same direction from where you're looking. You know, the Israelites were now in the land. They had struggled coming into the land. It is the period of the judges. And at first, as they entered the land, they had some successes and some failures. And some of them moved swiftly into areas with great faith, and they were able to overcome the Canaanites. However, too often, the Canaanites resisted and were more effective in conquering, or at least subduing, or even oppressing the Israelites. And that's going to be the case of our lesson today. You know, we are commissioned as saints to conquer our flesh. And the illustration is well taken. We are really conquering our Canaanite flesh. Canaanite flesh of hearts that are filled with pride, selfishness, and bitterness, where we may even idolize the flesh, and so forth. Are we ruthless in suppressing the Canaanite within us? The Canaanites that would destroy that opportunity we have before us of not only walking with Jesus, but walking into the kingdom when it is in full power and glory? Have we asked our captain to help us? Have we sought his help daily, hourly, moment by moment, not waiting just till the end of the day for a closing prayer when we're weary and can barely express a word or two before we collapse into sleep? That's for those who can sleep, of course. Some of us are at the age where we find that sleep has its problems. As our lesson begins, we find out that Ehud, who was a judge and one who had provided Israel with some stability, spiritual stability, we might call it. But when he died, Israel reverted into the harlotry of going after the Canaanite gods. Now, that's going to repeat itself. It seems almost every time a major judge vanishes from the scene, they slip into this harlotry. Let's turn to Judges 4, if we're not there already. We'll read verse 1. Then the sons of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord after Ehud died. And the religion of the people of the land was absolutely an abomination to God. And it was literally a disgrace to the human race. People with any sense of morality, any sense of ethics, would have found their religion abominable. Besides their sensual carnal worship, they even burned their children in sacrifice to their gods. Below the picture of Mount Tabor, you'll see on your paper a quotation from Rotherham. It comes at the end of Volume 1 of his work. It is his sort of an appendix, but it deals with the issue of were the Canaanites really worthy of being so completely wiped out. I would not suggest you read it right now, but it's there for you in case you have not read it in Rotherham or want to review it. So the children of Israel not only failed to destroy the Canaanites, but by intermarrying with them, remember Balaam, brethren, do we relax and slip into carnal thinking, evil surmising, some of the Canaanites of our flesh, in other words? Do we burn, not literally our children, but do we burn our brethren through evil speaking? Do we burn them? These Israelites were enticed by their Canaanite spouses into the worship of heathen gods. And so the Lord let them take the consequences, as he told them they would. In verse 2 we read, and the Lord sold them. Interesting language. The Lord sold them into the hand of Jabin of Canaan, who resided in Hazor. Hazor is a city in the north, and it lays idle at this point. Its ruins still remain. Some have visited it. You remember Hazor, Debbie? Yeah. The dragons crawling in and out of little holes. A commander of his army, Sisera, was there. Jabin was the king, Sisera his general, and the city, Hazor. One would say, well, so what? But in fact, the Lord had allowed them to fall into the hands of this man who oppressed them for 20 years. And it was about the end of that 20 years that the children of Israel began to cry out for help to the Lord. We often wonder why these things came in this way. Why did they seem to wait so long? But we have to reflect. How long do we wait, having given lease to our own fleshly failings, before we begin to ask the Lord for help to rein them in or to destroy them? The children of Israel were forced into an oppressive servitude, and this army was equipped with a fighting force that included 900 chariots made of iron. Verse 3, and the sons of Israel cried unto the Lord, for he, Sisera, had these 900 chariots, and he oppressed the sons of Israel severely for 20 years. And finally they picked up, but it suggests that no man was so motivated to do anything. Because of the delinquency of men, evidently, the Lord raised up a noble woman, a mother in Israel, by her own words, into public service by divine providence. The woman, of course, Deborah. And this is the story of a woman doing, perhaps we might say, a man's work. So as the narrative draws us to the life of Deborah, we find that she was judging in Israel, she was nurturing, she was instructing, And she had this unusual position of being a judge sitting under a palm tree, listening to the complaints and concerns, responding to them. You might know that in the city gates of a city, sometimes the elders would sit. You might remember this from the days of Lot, from the days of Boaz, where they went to the gates of the city where they could make judgments in certain matters. Verse 4 and 5, now Deborah, a prophetess, wife of Lapidoth, was judging Israel at that time. And she used to sit under the palm tree of Deborah between Ramah and Bethel in the hill country of Ephraim. And the sons of Israel came up to her for judgment. A common practice to administer judgment in the open air under the canopy of the trees, as well as the city gates. Now finally, Deborah is admonished, rather should I say, Deborah admonishes that this is the time to do something. This is the time for deliverance. And what does she do? But she summons Barak. I find it kind of paradoxical that, and this is very much an aside, that it is Ehud Barak, the man who was recently a prime minister, named after these two individuals, who was prepared to give away virtually the heartland of Israel back in the last century, a couple of years ago. Verse 6. Now she sent and summoned Barak from Kadesh Naphtali and said to him, behold, the Lord, the God of Israel, has commanded, go and march to Mount Tabor and take with you 10,000 men from the sons of Naphtali and the sons of Zebulun. That's a lot of people. If you think back to how big the mountain looks, where are you going to put 10,000 people? But they went there. Verse 7, and I will draw out to you Sisera, the commander of Jabin's army, with his chariots and his many troops to the river Kishon, and I will give him into your hand. Now notice, Deborah tells Barak that the Lord will draw out Sisera to him and give him to your hand. How does that happen? Remembering, of course, that the battle is the Lord's, we could assume that he has everything prearranged. You may recall from other battles in the past how the Lord set an ambush, how the Lord caused others to hear chariots, and as a result, whole armies were devastated in various ways, or fled. When we come to Mount Tabor, we try to imagine what does this place look like in close-up life. Some of us who've gone up Tabor realize it's a very steep mountain area. And if you were traveling in Israel with a bus, you might say, well, let's just drive up to the top of Tabor. But they hadn't built a road to accomplish that, but rather there's a series of switchbacks at one end where literally only a taxi cab, could take you to the top, which is the way we got to the top. But you could see that 900 chariots would have little opportunity to be of any effect in hurting the men at the top of Tabor. So they were pretty safe there. Well, what happens next? The Kishon, which lies beneath Tabor and runs out toward the sea, if you were to view it, for example, even from Mount Carmel, it looks just like a dry riverbed, which it virtually is. I suppose that's something like the Platte River, which they say is a mile wide and an inch deep, out in Nebraska. Well, this one's not a mile wide, but it's only about an inch deep. It's a very small river, and you wonder how in the world could anybody have any problems there, as you're going to find in a short distance of time in our reading here. But the whole thing drains the land in such a way, as wadis usually do, and it becomes a torrent when it has to be filled with water by such things as rain downpours and rainy season experiences. Under divine guidance, Barak with his 10,000 are at the top of Tabor. He has an army base, you might say, at that location. He realizes his troops are safe there, and he's waiting for further instructions by the mouth of Deborah. Well, you might ask yourself, well, what do you mean by Deborah? Didn't she send him there? Well, it's not quite that simple, as you might know from the story. But something else about Tabor. Brother Russell calls our attention to the fact that Mount Tabor is probably the Mount of Transfiguration, a place where the three apostles saw Jesus with Moses and Elijah, a picture of the Messianic kingdom. How appropriate that this location within the valley of Armageddon, or should I say of Megiddo, the valley of Jezreel, actually, but is associated with Megiddo, would be a place so closely associated physically with Tabor, which pictures the kingdom. So as we look at the experience of the Armageddon conclusion of the age and recognize the kingdom is sitting right there to begin its process, then we can see the connection physically in the land between these two physical places. Indeed, Armageddon precedes the glorious kingdom of Christ. Now, it is interesting also in Daniel 11 that Napoleon is spoken of as having gone to the glorious mountain, which undoubtedly is also this Tabor. From another place in history sources, we found a reference to the fact that Napoleon actually encountered a group of Turks at Tabor, and they, the Turks, were actually wiped away by a flood that occurred in the Kishon, evidently helping him also, although he needed a lot more than help at that point. He was in big trouble. And you know he fled back to the European turf that he belonged to. Well, Napoleon was fulfilling Scripture, but not by faith. On the other hand, Barak was fulfilling Scripture, but by faith. But not so fast, because although he went to Mount Tabor, there was some hesitation. He seemed to have lacked the faith that would have said, "Deborah, I understand what the Lord wants me to do. I'm going to Mount Tabor. See you later." But that's not what he said. Not at all. But do we lack faith? Do we ever seek to lean on someone else besides leaning on the Lord fully? The Lord used Deborah to help Barak. We sometimes have our Deborahs to help us along our way. In verse 8, we read, "Then Barak," and we're going to go on till 10, "Then Barak said to her, 'If you will go with me, then I will go. But if you will not go with me, I will not go.'" Doesn't sound like a valiant leader at this moment. But then again, we might recall the way Gideon was evaluating his situation when approached by an angel. Continuing in verse 9, "And she said, 'I will surely go with you. Nevertheless, the honor shall not be yours on the journey that you are about to take. For the Lord will sell Sisera into the hands of a woman.' Then Deborah arose and went with Barak to Kadesh. And Barak called Zebulun and Naphtali together to Kadesh. 10,000 men went up with him. Deborah also went up with him." So it wasn't so much the 10,000 men that gave him courage, but the one woman. Actually, Deborah was a prophetess, and here she was prophesying what would happen to Sisera and how he would fall by the hands of a woman. And maybe in a double sense, even by her own hand, because she was a part of this force at Tabor. But it is Barak that is honored in Hebrews 11's Hall of Fame. Brethren, do we not have to express ourselves in our being in faith to be overcomers in this race for our lives? And yet sometimes our faith doesn't seem strong enough. But the Father does give us others to lean upon. And maybe this is an encouragement to the sisters, because it is often their own comments. And I mean this in a sense not of great approbativeness and all sorts of making to-do about something, but very often the sisters are able, through carefully listening to the comments of the brothers, give them encouragement and tell the brothers how this or that doctrinal teaching, this or that character lesson, this or that prophetic understanding has been helpful to them through their ministry, which is an encouragement to the brothers. So don't belittle your opportunities of service even in that way. Now, remember, God told Deborah that he would draw out Sisera down to Barak's force. He was the commander, remember, of Jabin's army, and Jabin was the one who was oppressing the Israelites. He was the Canaanite king, and he still had his stronghold at Hazor. He had the chariots, the 900 iron chariots, and he came up to the river Kishon, and he was to be given into the hand of the Israelites by the Lord. So here's how it arranges itself. Maybe even parenthetically we should mention here, how did they come to Tabor, these 900 chariots with their army? It seems that the people who lived nearby, who were at peace with both Israel and this Canaanite king Jabin, who were called Kenites, played a part in the beginning of this battle. Judges 4:11-13 tells us, now Heber, the Kenite, had separated himself from the Kenites, from the sons of Hobab, the father-in-law of Moses. Try to picture in your mind this scenario. Moses is about to go on his trek, and he speaks to Jethro's family and says, come with us. And some of them did, evidently. But even here, this Heber had separated himself, and they dwelt in tents, but not moving around. They were, in a sense, permanent residents in this area. They had peace with Jabin, and they seemed to play a role of being helpful. Apparently, they were useful because they were workers of metal. So other people thought this was good, that they could use these people's talents. But somehow we have to understand that because they came with Moses and he said that the Lord will give you the blessings that we receive, that they must have been very kindly to the Israelites and very close to them. But then this is expressed in verse 12. Now this would either be Heber or Heber and his clan or some of the clan, told Sisera that Barak, the son of Abinoam, had gone to Mount Tabor. It sounds like they're double-crossing the Israelites. And Sisera called together all his chariots, 900 iron chariots, and all the people who were with him from Harosheth Hagoyim to the river Kishon. How in the world could they be friends and do such a thing? Well, again, we know that the Lord knows how to set ambushes. So someone had this put into their mind to reveal to Sisera, the enemy, that Barak, the Israelite, was doing this launching of a campaign, apparently, from the top of Tabor. When Sisera learned that he was there, he formed his army and he came. Now, he came with his 900 chariots. You know, when we face the conflicts that are in front of us, when we resolve to try to conquer our own flesh, do we feel as if 900 chariots of iron are standing in array against us? Are we responding in such a way that we're fearful? We have this, this dangerous, strange things happen. Testing. Immediately then, some of the brethren might tell us, I've lost my place. Say this, we want to conquer our flesh. We make a resolve. But then the chariots come. How do they come? They come in the form of somebody patting us on the back. We want to conquer pride, but somebody's patting us on the back. They're saying, oh, such a good lesson today. That was such a one. And they're doing it in such a way that it's not just, I got a blessing because you said this, and that's very helpful. They're saying it in such a way that you feel, oh, honored. Now the pride is welling back up. Here we were trying to face off these 900 chariots, and they're coming at us. and the brethren are just tapping us on the back. But our self has the ability to absorb this and say, yes, I did do a good job, didn't I? That's the flesh. So Deborah is called to action. Deborah, the one who was asked for help in difficulty. And Deborah says to Barak, arise, for this is the day, verse 14, which the Lord has given Sisera into your hands. Behold, the Lord has gone out before you. That's the way we should face our flesh. The Lord has gone out before us to conquer these Canaanites. The Lord comes to our rescue miraculously. In fact, it's because of the Lord's overruling sometimes that we make these blunders. Brother Mark Chastain has often said, Lord goes to great trouble to make sure we fall on our face. I don't know if that's a direct quote, Mark. But that's the point. Great. Why? Here we're just almost filled with pride because someone has said something and right on our face. We say something stupid. And so the pride is washed away for the moment, maybe only for the moment. Let's continue reading 14. So Barak went down from Mount Tabor with 10,000 men following him. And the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and his army with the edge of the sword before Barak. And Sisera alighted from the leader. Notice Barak is leading his forces. Sisera's army's in trouble. He jumps off and runs away the other way. This is not uncommon, even in modern day with Israel, where the leaders go first into the battle. Not recommending that we follow suit in literal battles. Where did I leave off? Okay, the Lord routed Sisera and all his chariots and his army by the edge of the sword before Barak, and Sisera alighted from his chariot and fled away on foot. But Barak pursued the chariots and the army, and all the army of Sisera fell by the edge of the sword. Not even one was left except Sisera. How did the Lord rout the army? It's not explained in chapter 4, but it does appear in the Song of Deborah, which appears in chapter 5, where at verse 20 of chapter 5 and 21, it says, the stars fought from heaven. From their courses they fought Sisera. The torrent of Kishon swept them away, the ancient torrent Kishon, the torrent Kishon. It's not a torrent most of the time. It required intervention on the part of the Lord to bring this rain to wash these people away. Deborah said, God used the stars to fight for Israel. Do we ever wonder how the Lord has intervened in our life to save us from impossible predicaments, overcoming the enemies within our own flesh? Think about it. He used the stars. The rabbis comment on this, and they say that the rabbis say that the stars were the unpaid fighters who God enlisted in their courses from their highways. In other words, the paths of nature had allotted them in the skies. The heavenly bodies that rule the seasons, the weather, helped the Hebrews. A great storm and a cloudburst swelled the river, making quagmires of the lower valley. And as a result, the chariot wheels would have been bogged down. His soldiers fled, cut down by the Israelites. Thousands swept in the freshets down to the sea. Sisera was stuck in the mud too, but he checked out and went in a different direction. To produce a very interesting end to this story. And Sisera, by the way, flees for sanctuary to the Kenites. No doubt he felt that they were to be trusted. There was peace with the Kenites. And he came to the tent of a woman named Yael. You'll forgive me pronouncing the J as a Y, but Yael, Heber's wife. He was the one in the first place that or his clan, that told Sisera about the Israelites. And now, somewhat poetic justice, he flees to this tent. Now Sisera fled away, in verse 17, on foot to the tent of Yael, the wife of Heber, the Kenite. For there was peace between Jabin, the king of Hazor, and the house of Heber the Kenite. What Sisera failed to realize, perhaps, was that the Kenites, although nomadic, had this historical link and bond with the Israelites through Moses' family association. Sisera had sought help from the wrong nomadic family, and it was his undoing. In verse 18, Yael goes out to meet Sisera and says to him, "Turn aside, my master. Turn aside to me. Do not be afraid." And he turned aside into her tent, and she covered him with a rug. Almost reminds me of Rahab covering the spies, but she covers him. She protects him. In verse 19, he said unto her, "Please give me a little water to drink, for I am thirsty." So she opened a container of milk and gave him drink. It was kind of what you'd call sour milk, or like a buttermilk, which is, of course, what they enjoyed. And he said to her, "Stand in the doorway of the tent, and if it said by anyone, 'Is there anyone here?' you will say no." Now let's just pause a moment before we go any further. Yael. I thought about that name. Apparently it means a wild goat. Yael. But as I break down the word and I see Yah and El, and I think about the meaning of it, it should mean Jehovah is God. Evidently, her parents might have thought that was a good name to give her if you construct it out of Yah and El. If you take the words and you rotate them, so it's El Yah, Eliyah, you have Elijah. It's not a very difficult thing to see. In fact, some have observed, in fact, not too long ago, that Eliyah, to just pronounce the word, is to say, "My God is Jehovah, Elijah." But this one, the opposite. Jehovah is God. Another thing about Yael, she had to know that Sisera was a man of war who took advantage of situations. And certainly she knew that the people of the Canaanites were despicable in their practices. And certainly she also knew that if the Israelites lost this battle, and Sisera were to be victorious in somehow, and she didn't necessarily know what was happening to the rest of the group, although she might have assumed as much, she might have assumed that she might have been taken captive or as a slave herself. How do we know that? Well, it was very common practice. Slaves were taken as one military force came into the place of another. And I'd like you to think, in a sense, when Sisera's mother later is mourning, is saying, "Where is my son? Why hasn't he come back yet? He should be coming back by now, bringing some damsels with him." In other words, captured women. So this is not a supposition that is far out of field. Yael might have analyzed the whole situation. In fact, you know, Brother Russell treats this matter, and is she a murderess? What does she do? Has she violated the code of ethics of hospitality? She did, after all, invite him into the tent. She protected him. She says, "Don't be afraid." She gave every appearance that she was a friend. We wonder whether the Lord motivated her at the beginning, at the middle, or toward the end of this experience to do what she did. But nevertheless, whatever the motivation, she seems to have taken action swiftly and with deliberation. Because it says that she took, in verse 21, a tent peg and seized a hammer in her hand and went secretly to him, and drove the peg into his temple, and it went into the ground. For he was sound asleep and exhausted. Some people who have read about this somehow read into it that he somehow rose up looking at her and then collapsed. But I don't think so, because as we read the next verse, it seems that she fixed him to the ground pretty firmly. And behold, Barak pursued Sisera. Yael came out to meet him and said to him, "Come, and I will show you the man whom you are seeking." She knew all this. And he entered with her, and behold, Sisera was lying dead with the tent peg in his temple. Now, it doesn't say it was pinned into the ground. That's true. But nevertheless, she did the deed. So we wonder, was she a murderess? Well, if killing is murder, yes. if she was carrying out the Lord's execution of a man who would have just as soon killed 10,000 Israelites, maybe herself, or taken her as a slave, well, then we might view it slightly differently. And certainly there's a lot of controversy. Did she violate the law of hospitality? Is she an outright murderess? Or is he, by going into her tent, or approaching her tent even, liable to be punished in some way because you don't approach the tent of a woman without potentially risking your life? A woman who's not your wife, that is, or your family member. So some say he was worthy of death by having stepped into this tent, invitation or not. And yet, because of this relationship that she had, we feel that she may have had a lot more focus on what the God of Israel was about to do or had done, and how their people had been blessed by the Israelites' relationship with them, which is exactly what Moses told Hobab would happen if Hobab threw in his lot with them and they traveled toward Canaan together, which is in fact what happened. What she did was essentially the work of God's judgment. You know, the Lord could have used hornets to drive out the Canaanites. He could have used the opening of the earth. He could have caused earthquakes of some sort or another. He did, in fact, at different times create different kinds, as we mentioned before, ambushes. He made arrangements. He made arrangements behind the scenes, so to speak. You might say, she was like a female Samson, a one-woman army, taking care of the leader of a violent, wicked Canaanite group of people, the head of their army. And an ancient worthy. Or was she an ancient worthy? Well, based on the fact that it's printed on the program, I think she's an ancient worthy. But beside that, she's commended as blessed. Blessed among the women of the tent. Most blessed of women is Yael, the wife of Heber the Kenite. Most blessed is she of the women of the tent. That's a pretty strong commendation, even though she's not showing up in Hebrews 11. But for that matter, neither is Deborah. And she was a judge. And she was a prophetess. What she did in reality was the work of God's judgment. She was his instrument. And that's what's celebrated, not her mode of carrying out the execution, as grisly as it might sound to us. This account has a very poignant, unique, but consistent storyline. And that last scene in the Song of Deborah, where Sisera's mother is waiting for him to come home, wondering why he hasn't returned, she knows that he went out to conquer and to take and destroy human life. And she was comfortable with that. She was even comfortable with the fact that they would go out and they'd bring back the women as slaves. No problem. But then again, she was a Canaanite mom. Worshipped a Canaanite god, had the mentality of worshiping a rather wicked religious system. Verse 31, so let all thine enemies perish, O Lord, but let them that love him be as the sun when he goeth forth in his might, and the land had rest for 40 years. You know, when you hear that the land had rest for 40 years, you almost breathe a sigh of relief. Almost. Why not more than 40? Because once again, Israel will turn to be the harlot and go after other gods. And so, tragically, when you hear this, it sounds, oh, yes, but no, it has its end. They slip backwards. They fall backwards. We are thankful that Israel's enemies are not doomed to destruction as many of our Christian friends would place them, in a doom of torment forever. They will have an opportunity at life. They will have an opportunity to reap the blessings of Christ's kingdom. Isaiah 60, verse 14 tells us, "The sons also of them that afflicted thee shall come bending unto thee." So there will be a time when the Siseras, the Jabins, and all of their host will come forth from the grave and come to these princesses, these ancient ones, and to Israel, and they will bend the knee. "And all they that despise thee shall bow themselves at the soles of thy feet, and they shall call thee the city of the Lord, the Zion of the Holy One of Israel." When we hear the words of these lessons, of this cloud of witnesses, cloud of martyrs, witnesses, martyrs, as if they were in grandstands all around us, let's not be intimidated by our fleshly 900 chariots that face off with us every day. Remember, in faith, let's charge down the mountain. Go after those enemies. God has the ability to wash them away with a flood of truth. As we make these lessons our daily, like today's manna, little by little, step by step, we can do the work of ridding our flesh. But as we've read in recent either Songs of the Night or Manna, we must think in terms of filling our minds daily with that which is good and pure, manna. And what for? To wash away that which is vile. There isn't any of us, maybe there is someone, but there is hardly any of us who has not been faced or confronted with the vileness of our society and infected in one way or another by it. How do we get rid of it? It's the proverbial washing it away with the water of the Word, the water of truth. The more we fill the heart and mind with the Word of truth, the less room there is for the vile thoughts, the unpleasant thoughts, the evil thoughts, and even the evil surmisings, which can lead to evil speaking or evil gestures of the face. God made the stars in their courses, and He can arrange to conquer the fleshly mindedness of our flesh. And we then can be more victorious daily. If our faith is not strong enough to charge down that mountain by ourselves, perhaps a Deborah will be given to us as assistance. As an assistant, as an encourager, as an inspirer. And I don't mean a sister specifically, someone. In the meantime, we can all try to be mothers or fathers in Zion, nurturing and encouraging. Everyone needs some nurturing and some encouraging. Being an example, sometimes by bringing concerns to our brother's attention in a loving way, guiding and assisting. Remembering every time we go to someone with an issue, look to ourselves. How are we of the same cloth? Let's remember that our view is a view from Mount Tabor, a kingdom perspective, though we stand at this valley of Megiddo. The Lord bless your meditations this weekend as you absorb the lessons and seek to apply them in each life, each day, each hour.
Thank you, Brother Bob. Appreciate your service. Well, you have a few extra minutes of fellowship time here. We'll break until 11:15. Let us close with hymn number 152, and we'll ask Brother Bob to dismiss us with prayer. 152. Bob's request, Brother Jim Watkins will dismiss us with prayer.
Our most kind and gracious Heavenly Father, hallowed be thy most holy name. We come before the throne of grace this morning, thanking you so much for the privileges and opportunity to gather together in convention and to study about the cloud of witnesses. We thank you so much for those faithful of the past who are examples and guides for us. We thank you so much for the trials and the experiences that we have had, the experiences that are helping us to conquer the Canaanite in our flesh. We thank you for the joys. We thank you for the sorrows. We thank you for all the trials and the experiences that we all are enduring. And now we ask your blessings upon the remainder of the convention. We ask your blessings upon our fellowship. We ask your blessings upon the speakers and the other lessons that we'll have from the platform. And we ask forgiveness where we fall short. We ask forgiveness for anything that we may say or do amiss. And we ask all these things in your dear Son Jesus' name. Amen.